This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Today, we'll be revealing and rewiring the sometimes murky debate about robotics. Far from decrying progress or losing sleep over how they'll one day overthrow us, we'll be seeing how robots can refine the design process. We meet the creators of a new piece of machinery that's lending a hand, or should we say robotic arm, to designers here in London. Plus,
we think we are making decisions, but those decisions have already been made for us by the type of robot we're using.
We speak to one of the directors over at the Robotics Lab of the University College London to ask what designers can expect from robots in the future. Also ahead, I welcome Disegno's editor-in-chief, Ollie Stratford, to leaf through a stack of magazines that he turns to for inspiration.
What I like is just picking a single theme and then showing the sort of myriad of ways you can write about that and access that topic.
All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, after becoming frustrated with working on glitchy robots while at Zaha Hadid Architects, Sir Yansh Chandra and Mustafa El Sayed decided to go it alone in 2015. The plan? To launch their own robotics company named Automata. The core product was a robotic arm known simply as Eva, and it's the result of 4 years of trial and error, plus it'll be available to buy from this March. The robot aims to be affordable and accessible, designed to mimic a variety of manual design tasks but without the need for complex programming on the part of the user. Monocle's always inquisitive Paige Reynolds visited Automata's Clerkenwell office and testing room here in London. Take it away, Paige.
We work for a very famous architect, Zaha Hadid. She has one of the most forward-thinking architecture practices in the world, and we both ended up working in the research group in that office for about 6 years. Essentially, that office is full of like creative mad geniuses who are very, very good at conceiving crazy complex things to build. And we were kind of sort of the nerdy group in that who was like educated as designers, but we had a fair bit of math and coding skills to figure out how to take those complex things and make them real. We wanted to go out and buy robots instead to see whether we can do something better. That turned out to be really expensive for an architect's salary. So from that point, we were like, okay, architects know how to build buildings, how hard can robots be? And just a bunch of sticks and mortars. So with that sort of combination of arrogance and ignorance, we started building this thing, and little did we know how much and how long it would take.
So the robotics arm is called Eva.
Yes.
If you were sort of just to let me know, if I'm a designer, what sort of three things could Eva do to make my life easier?
Things along the lines of photography. Basically, it's universal dolly, right? It can go to any position in any way, repeatedly over and over, whether that means it has advantages for people doing stop-motion animation or advantages for people trying to do very kind of interesting pan shots. We've seen that use case quite a lot. Apart from that, there's interest in things like people visualizing the output of some of the software they develop. What I mean by that, there's a lot of, I think it's referred to as computational art. There's people trying to externalize that work. Right. Currently, computational art lives on a 2D screen, and there's a huge potential to transfer that world into the world of robot, the three-dimensional motion through robotics, whether that means just visualizing that motion in the robot arm, or we've seen a lot of interesting people, for example, putting strobe lights on the end of the robot, and in a dark room, you essentially get a three-dimensional experience through a robotic arm.
Interestingly, over a third of our inbound is from creatives, and they come up with such bizarre, all sorts of like radical ideas that we didn't think were ever possible. So in some way for us, the creatives are sort of the flag bearers of opening up new worlds with new technologies like this. So in some way there are template things that we can do, and those were the ones that we were aware of when we were architects. But what we're starting to see now is like people in music, people in photography are starting to come up with things that we never thought a robot could do.
This here is a conveyor belt.
Right.
And this is what you would normally see in an automated work environment like a factory or something like that, where the conveyor belt is moving parts and you have a robot that is either putting stuff on the conveyor belt and or taking stuff off of a conveyor belt to put it into a machine. So what you see here is essentially a laptop which is not plugged into the robot in any way, but the robot is just another computer that sits on your network, and you can, through your computer, through any computer, access the robot software. And then there's a little toggle here which allows you to take ownership, and once you have ownership of a robot, you can essentially control it from here. So the two buttons are the main interface of the robot. So the simplest way of programming the robot is, once it's ready or switched on, you're essentially pressing one of those two buttons, and you can see the software starts to respond the moment you press it.
Okay.
And the software is literally, this pressing this button allows you to literally back drive or grab and, okay, and show Eva what you want it to do.
So Eva's very receptive sort of to human motions.
Yeah. Okay. So if you try to move it now, it won't let you do that. But you want to try it yourself?
Can I try it? Okay. So I'm pressing the lower button
press
here.
Press and hold the lower button.
This is quite scary. Okay. And it's
gone green.
And now
just
move
it around. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Gosh, it's a lot more flexible and sort of tactile than you imagine it. It moves quite slowly, but in a reassuring way, yes, I suppose, when you're dealing with a robotic arm.
You don't want the robot to be moving faster than you want it to
no.
move.
Okay, and then as soon as I release the button, it stops.
And if you press the other button, it records a position in that location. So you see now, if I move the robot out, that's the point you recorded.
Okay.
So there's a 3D location in space that would have been very hard for you to measure, but by dragging the robot into that position, that makes it super easy for you to find a three-dimensional position. So a basic task can be set up in like less than 15 minutes.
Wow.
I think what's interesting to mention, like you're looking at the software here on our laptop screen, is that, like we were mentioning, this is a 3D environment, and it's super intuitive to understand. Like, it's a point relative to your robot. That's it, it's so easy. A lot of other robots, that is represented by a number and a bunch of coordinates.
So this is a bunch of joints of robots running 24/7 for months on end, essentially trying to break themselves.
Okay. So,
and they're all running faster and more loaded than they would actually be in real life circumstances and things. So we have calibrated ways of overloading things and then running them for months or years sometimes.
Wow.
But it gets iterated upon pretty quickly. So we have set points like every 3 months or 2 weeks or whatever, depending on what the test is. We open it up and measure how badly has it worn.
It looks quite dystopian, doesn't it, when you look in there?
Version of this wall being full of robots doing the same thing. So at some point you'll see stacks of robots trying to break themselves.
And this is, I presume this is a safety measure. So you're just trying to make them as safe as possible, right?
It's lifetime testing, essentially. So when you build something, you have to break it yourself before you get let others break it.
Okay.
So this is kind of that. And this is why it takes so much time to build a product which has any mechanical engineering elements to it. We have two of these Wi-Fi baby monitor cameras that monitor all of these things, and then there's a computer that is plugged into them, which basically, if one of them stops unexpectedly, it'll ping the right person a message on the computer saying, hey, this thing stopped.
Have you ever been stopped in the middle of the night?
Oh yeah, lots of times.
Really?
Loads of times.
Amazing. Do you think now, if you went back to being purely architects, do you think you'd have a sort of very different vision about sort of even how to go about designing? Because I genuinely think it's really interesting, because you sort of almost getting involved in the engineering side in a way brings you back to sort of the craft of it. And do you think you'd might have a different opinion, I suppose, about how to approach design?
I undervalued creativity while I was in a creative discipline personally. I don't know if you've had the same journey, but to me, it was the only way to think. It was obvious, and I thought everybody thought like that. And then when you step out of it, and then now we are practically, I think, design is the minority upstairs. It's mostly engineering and commercials and other sort of functions. So you start to realize that you have a particularly unique education that allows you to be naive and ignorant, but you can do pattern recognition much quicker, and you're very good at looking at something completely unfamiliar and unknown, and you're very good at finding your way through it very quickly and then getting to the sense of it.
Yeah, if we went back to being architects, the thing I would take with me from this journey was, because like Srinjit is saying, we now understand how valuable creativity is, and kind of seeing what others don't sometimes, is that the incredible value of cross-disciplinary work. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes in design we tend to be insular, especially sometimes the big city communities like London. the value of what you can do when you have multiple skill sets around the table is incredible. And I think another skill that we've discovered that design makes you do, and I think it's the nature of our education, that you constantly have to present and defend your work, is that you can bring those people with you, right? Like, you can stand up there, paint that picture, get that vision on the wall and be like, this is why we're doing it, and this is how we're gonna do it, and bring that cross-disciplinary team with you. And I think if design should increasingly embrace that, and I think its role will really, really, in my opinion, re-flourish.
Our sincere thanks to Monocle's Paige Reynolds there, speaking to the founders of robotics company Automata here in London. Now, to get a better understanding of just how much progress has been made in the use of robots and their application in the field of design, I went looking for some answers, and I found Peter Scully. He's the technical director at the Bartlett Manufacturing and Design Exchange at University College London. Over the past few years, UCL has invested heavily in automation and new resources, as well as workshop facilities, including those that expose students to the potential use of robots. So how effectively do robots work in a design lab, and how far do we still need to go? Well, here's Peter Scully to explain a little more.
So you've got elements such as design being aided by robots. So a robot doesn't have to be physical. It could be a piece of AI, it could be a numerical solver, it could be an algorithm, a piece of software, or whatever. So you've already got elements of automated design, and also robots need to be considered as just one of the key players in automation. But then we've got an awful lot of design around at the moment that is barely able to harness the affordances of established technology. So how long have we been seeing furniture being made by CNC machines? It's a fair while, but it's not that long. Our buildings are still informed by products. Often our buildings are a curation of many different products, rather than the designer saying, I want this, and then that product is made for this. Costs and time and lead time all play a role in that. And then we've got the really grey area of what do robots do well? A robot is an unfinished machine. So we take a delivery from a large brand manufacturer and we unpackage our robot. We plug it in, we learn to code for it. It can't actually do anything yet until we put an end effector, such as a drill, or a pick and place end effector, or a water jet, or a plasma cutter. The robot is really something that manipulates established material manipulation tools. So the designer that can exploit the affordances of a tool shouldn't have too much of a leap to be able to exploit the affordances of a tool that has now got six axes of freedom, so X, Y, and Z, and A, B, and C, or rotation. Decision-making in design is a massive research field. You know, how we bias, how we unbias, how we make decisions, and we think we are making decisions, but those decisions have already been made for us by the type of robot we're using, or the type of milling head we're using, or the type of the specific attributes that a manufacturing tool naturally does. So it is a huge area. If I was to say there was a danger, I would suspect that the danger would be much more about, as designers, we aren't being fundamentally creative enough. We are curating the attributes of different tools, the curve, the spline, the radius, the type of joint. We begin to curate attributes instead of design to exploit those attributes. We're working from within a quite sophisticated but finite palette of techniques and processes. And if we don't really understand those techniques and processes and how they work in the real world, their longevity, their applications, their material specific natures and so on, we become very much forced to use what we know. And so therefore, that isn't a great tool of design. We become curators rather than designers. I think as the technology stops being technology, you know, at one point, our cars and our vacuum cleaners were regarded as in the same honorary space that our robots are today. As technology becomes useful, it kind of disappears and it becomes the object. As our robots, as our computational power, as our new tools, as our established tools that are now being manipulated by automation, etc., as we start to become more au fait with them, I think we're going to find new uses for them, new markets, new products. An awful lot of our technology has been evolved to make components that had to be made faster, stronger, better, etc. You know, parts for aerospace, automation, automotive. You know. And yet, those very demanding parts have curated these quite extraordinary machines, really specific machines. And those machines, I don't think really have been seen as the starting point for what they could make. When you start looking at how the, for instance, the built environment utilizes technology, it utilizes technology very badly at the moment in our houses and our cities and so on. But once we start using the technology as a starting point, we may start seeing uses for our houses to be built off-site, to be built faster off-site, to have longer lifetimes, to be built for maintenance, to be built for social benefits, to be able to plug into how we deliver things to houses, how we buy and sell houses. The technology really hasn't been utilized by the built environment in any meaningful sense yet.
Peter Scully there, Technical Director at the Bartlett Manufacturing and Design Exchange at University College London. Thank you very much, Peter. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in studio now by the editor-in-chief, no less, of Disegno magazine. And Ollie, you are lending your voice and your wisdom to a format that I've stolen from our sister show, The Stack, The Print Industry Review. We have in front of us a panoply of printed pages and some of your favourites that you'd like to guide us through. Is that right?
Yeah, so I've picked a few different titles, some sort of more core, I suppose, traditional design magazines, and then a few outliers, which is something that a little bit is what Disegno aims to do. We want to write about design, but we also want to write about the areas that shape the design industry. So I've tried to reflect that in the choices. So on my way here, I decided to try and break the format and spring some magazines on you.
I like this already.
Yeah, well, nothing if not rebellious at Disegno. So I tried to buy some couple of extra ones. And it suddenly occurred to me quite how expensive magazines are. So I think I tried to buy two magazines and it was £43, which is kind of ridiculous. It's not the magazine's fault. That's clearly the pricing they have to put themselves at to be sustainable. But that immediately puts them out of the hands of a lot of people. Like, I work in magazines. I would not spend that much to get them, though. You know, there's light and shade. It's fabulous that there's so much, but I think some questions as to the health of the industry should be asked.
I agree. And I would also add to that the dearth of kind of distribution points. I think there are countries that do news kiosks much better than the UK. There are countries that don't put their magazines upside down next to the sweets, as you always find them in W.H. Smith. And there are different ways of telling a magazine's story in the distribution world. I want to go straight to your first magazine. You talk about longevity. Granta is an amazing bookish collectible magazine that's been around in some form since the 1880s, but was kind of relaunched in the 70s. And it's not a political magazine. It's a magazine rallied usually around a kind of singular theme.
Yeah, so they pick a different theme each issue. Current issue is ghosts. I think recent ones, I remember Canada quite strongly. So there's no sort of rhyme or reason, really. And then it's a collection of new writing and sort of fiction and poetry around that theme. The reason I picked Granta and why I think it's so splendid is, at least within design writing, I think it can often be very limited. So if you read through most design magazines, what you get is studio visit after studio visit and a writer speaking about the white bare walls of the designer's studio and how much light flooded in, and isn't their collection of saucepans sourced from around the world fabulous? And that kind of has its place. That's fine. I think there's a real lack of variety in design writing. It doesn't draw upon quite a lot of those journalistic traditions you might take for granted in other areas. So travel writing, so court reporting or things like that. And what I like about Granta is just picking a single theme and then showing the sort of myriad of ways you can write about that and access that topic.
We're going to dive under the covers, you and I, Ollie, of a beautiful issue one of a new magazine, I believe, Clove magazine, which is dedicated to Southeast Asian culture. A rather striking image. Who's this gentleman on the front? He's some kind of colonial policeman, is he, wearing his aviators, under the title Shifting the Lens?
Yeah, well, I don't know the details of him. It's from this really fabulous story inside the magazine, which is a digital initiative documenting the Nepali people and the way in which studio photography has traced them over time. And the image is really remarkable. I don't know what decade that's from. Off the top of my head, maybe 70s or something like that.
It's a beautiful thing, isn't it? It's incredible.
Yeah, it looks like it could have come out of a contemporary fashion shoot or something. It's really fabulous. This guy, quite a thick moustache, he's in sort of, yeah, police uniform and then this sort of wide-brimmed hat and holding this kind of old-school radio. It's immediately arresting and it's a black-and-white image. And then you have this very heavy sort of yolky sunshine yellow font spread across it. I think it's really quite beautiful and quite an unusual image, really, to get on a magazine. You often get sort of very young, beautiful people on magazine, and not that this man's not beautiful, but there's a touch of the dad about him, which is quite nice.
Yeah, I completely agree, but maybe it's kind of invoking this kind of that Life magazine or older issues of Time, where you get a piece of reportage that takes you to a place that you haven't been to before. There's a little bit of kind of escapism to it. Ever the eye on business, I located a page in this magazine which talks about the editorial consultancy service which Clove do, called Clove Press, which also reveals that the team is London-based. So there is this focus on Southeast Asia. But again, we're seeing this business model where magazines offer some white label services. Maybe they offer some intelligence reporting. Maybe they can kind of wade in and help people with their advertising or with a particular project. Is that the way forward for magazines in an age where advertising is falling?
Whether it's the way forward, I don't know. At the moment, it certainly seems an inevitability. So everyone does this. Any magazine out there really will have a white label division that kind of props it up a little bit alongside print advertising. I think it's an important thing to do, and to an extent it maybe could be seen as freeing the editorial up from some of the demands of advertising. I think it's a strange thing more than anything. It's a very weird situation in which it now feels as natural and commonplace that a magazine and a magazine's editorial staff should be doing branded work for companies as it does for them to run a website or run a magazine. We do it at Decennial as well. It's a really important part of what we do, and it's fulfilling in its own way. But I think it probably is worth reflecting on a little bit how those two worlds sit alongside each other. What happens when a magazine gets into that world, which runs a bit close to advertising maybe, or consultancy, and how does that shape the two fields?
I agree. I think it's a very interesting thing. And you wouldn't always have got an advert in a magazine for those branded services that a magazine offers. So perhaps there's a new clarity, certainly in the mind of the folks at Clove magazine. You talked a little bit in the briefing notes about Clove being a welcome look away from the US and a welcome look away from Europe. We're going to focus on journeys again, though, for your next magazine pick, which is called Migrant Micro Odysseys. And I have to admit, this is an extremely, extremely intriguing choice, not one I've come across before. Slightly smaller than A4 format, with a lot of use of kind of fluoros, very text heavy in some places, but then amazing big spreads of photography, full bleed images and illustration. What on earth is this magazine about, Ollie?
Well, I'm quite late to the party on this as well. So it's a 6-part magazine, which is interesting that it set its own lifespan. It's kind of what it says. So it's devoted to looking at migration. And I think what it's trying to do is open up the ways we think of migration. So it's looking at migrations of peoples, of infrastructure, data flows, flora and fauna. So each issue has a slightly different theme. The most recent one, which is number 5, is looking at the world of micro and sort of flow of very small things. It's still very new to me as well, but I just find it a very intriguing magazine because it's taking, you know, a very serious topic, and I think a topic that could do with a little bit more nuance and could do with some more depth to it at a time when debates about migration have become very polarized and I think quite shallow and superficial and aggressive. So I quite admire what they're doing. Looking through its kind of serious, highly researched writing, it's academic, but I think has that nice trick of wearing its academia quite lightly. So as you say, it's very beautiful. There are these pops of this sort of fluoro-coral running through and then this kind of metallic gold. So it has this very well-defined colour palette that's quite poppy and fun and brings you in. So I think it's quite a clever design job of taking something that could be very, you know, off-putting and heavy and just giving it that level of intrigue to make you want to dive in and make you want to engage with that topic.
We do have enough time to delve into another title, which is the London Review of Books. Now, can I give you a confession here, Ollie? I've never read the London Review of Books. I prefer the New York Review of Books, the older sibling on which this is based.
Well, they're both great cities.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
And both great publications. But what draws you to the unabashed, text-heavy, newspaper-esque stylings of the London Review of Books?
I think the London Review of Books, everyone at Desenio on the editorial staff is subscribed to it. It's just the most fantastic research resource. So it's extremely long-form journalism, book reviews. So it takes a topic and then just delves into it, essays about that book and engaging with its content. And it kind of shows what you can do if you support long-form journalism and if writers have the time to research a topic and really get to grips with it. So you get these huge, often very stylishly written, not all the time, some are quite dry, but that's kind of what I admire about it, that it's unafraid to take on topics which on the surface could be very dry. And they're often quite niche, they're often quite historical, but through the strength of the writing and just the kind of classical journalism that has gone into it, it really draws you in and it becomes very gripping and you get into topics sort of like about 17th century diarists working in, I don't know, Durham, just writing endlessly about wool prices. But because of the way it's been dealt with, it becomes fascinating.
And my sincere thanks to Ollie Stratford. Ollie, you will be back to join us in April for the next issue of Desenio, won't you?
I certainly hope so.
Thank you very much. And sadly, that's all we have time for today. Next week, we sit down with Spencer Bailey, the charismatic new editor-in-chief at book publisher Fiden. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show or our sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up and leaf through a copy of Monocle magazine at your leisure or peruse our library of books or travel guides for a bit of inspiration. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett, and to play us out, it's Kraftwerk with Computer Love.